Baltic, to Trieste in the Adriatic, an iron curtain has descended across the continent. Berlin, Prague, Vienna, Budapest.
You may turn now.
Hi there, I'm Tom Morton. Welcome to Hindsight on Radio National and the second episode of Torn Curtain, the secret history of the Cold War. Today, spies, scientists and Australia's bid for the bomb. A nuclear thriller that brings together Ben Chifley, Robert Menzies and a Soviet spy ring in Canberra.
There had been some actual evidence of Soviet espionage in this regard.
I expect you're wondering what all this is made of.
If that doesn't incriminate me.
And there was sort of a newspaper headlines very soon about red atom bomb spy.
It's 1949, and the first great period of Cold War tension is reaching its height.
There's one fellow out in the front here who's calling out, down with the warmongers.
In Australia, anti-communist sentiment is running hot.
I wonder if he means down with the Soviet Union and its friends in Australia.
Robert Menzies speaking at a public meeting in 1949. Into this political drama walks Tom Kaiser, a brilliant young Australian physicist working in Britain. Kaiser goes along to a protest meeting in London, and within days he's caught up in a web of Cold War intrigue, stretching from London to Washington and Canberra, and centering on Australia's attempts to get nuclear weapons. But the Kaiser affair all started harmlessly enough at the time. Here's Philip Deary, Professor of History at Victoria University.
Well, Tom Kaiser was a young physicist who was working for the CSIRO at that time. He was on a scholarship at Oxford University and he'd just completed his PhD, and in fact he was waiting for the outcome of the result. And he became aware of a demonstration outside Australia House in the Strand. And because Tom had been a man of the left even before he arrived in England, he joined it. So for, I think it was quite a few hours, on a fairly warm day, because it was winter in Australia, of course, northern summer there, he stood with placards outside Australia House. The demonstration was to be his nemesis. Fairly innocuous initially, but it turned out to be the major turning point in his life.
At the demonstration, Tom Kaiser helped to hand out leaflets written by Daphne Gollan, one of a small group of young Australian communists living in London. The leaflets were protesting against the jailing of trade union leaders by the Chifley government during the 1949 coal strike.
Why this attack? Because Australia occupies an important place in the plans of groups in America and Britain who are planning a new world war. She is to be an arms and supply base for these groups. The workers are opposed to these war preparations, and so the Australian government has decided to destroy the democratic organisations of the people.
Well, the demonstration in London was something of a damp squib, attended by only a handful of people. But within weeks of handing out those leaflets, Tom Kaiser would lose his CSIRO scholarship, his job, and nearly his whole career. The Kaiser affair is a little-known chapter in Australia's Cold War history, but new research by the historian Philip Deary has revealed a much larger, darker dimension to Tom Kaiser's story. As we'll hear, Kaiser's fate became entwined with one of the most remarkable intelligence coups in Cold War history, a secret American code-breaking operation which revealed proof positive that senior Australian public servants were passing secrets to Moscow. Yet, according to his friend and colleague, the physicist Jack Kelly, Tom Kaiser hadn't actually intended to go to the protest in London in the first place.
He was a member of the Communist Party at that time, as many students were, and he was asked to go up for a demonstration in London, and he said, "No, look, I'm writing up my PhD, I don't have time, go away." But the demonstration was a bit thin, a couple of people got sick or chickened out, and they came round to him and said, "Oh, come on, Tom, you know, we need you." And he said, "Oh, all right." And so he went up to London and held up an inflammatory placard saying, "Don't be beastly to the miners," or something like that. And they were stamping around outside Australia House. And one of the girls in there said, "Oh, there's Tom Kaiser, the nuclear physicist." Now, he wasn't a nuclear physicist, but of course, in those bomb-happy days, every physicist was a nuclear physicist in the public mind. And standing alongside her, unfortunately, was a reporter. And this looked like a very tame sort of demonstration. He'd been sent to report on it, and there was nothing going. But an Australian nuclear physicist going on like this, that's headline stuff.
Atom scientist in red attack on Chifley government. London, Thursday. Thomas Kaiser, a scientist sent to England by the Australian government to study nuclear physics and atomic fission at Oxford, was among communists who demonstrated outside Australia House yesterday. Australia House officials tried to disperse the demonstrators, and the Australian government has been advised of the affair. 10 Australians picketed Australia House, handed out leaflets, and attacked the savage act of the Australian government in jailing union leaders. Kaiser, 26, had been a research officer for 6 years with the CSIR in Sydney and came here on a special scholarship in 1947. When his identity was discovered yesterday, security police were called to Australia House and a cable about his activities was sent to the Commonwealth Government last night by Acting High Commissioner Mr. Mile.
That's the story which the Sydney Sun ran the day after the demonstration. The very next day, the London Evening News picked it up and gave it a six-column headline. The press in Britain sniffed a scandal and complained that the authorities were trying to throw a blanket over the story. So why had such a tiny protest caused such a stir? Unbeknownst to him, Kaiser had stumbled into a shadowy world of secret atomic diplomacy involving the US, Britain and Australia. As a postgraduate student at Oxford, Kaiser had been working with Lord Chirwell, Churchill's personal scientific advisor during World War II.
Well, Chirwell was one of the main people involved in the development of the atomic weaponry in Britain at Harwell Institute. So we're talking about the development of atomic warfare. Now, this is at a time before the Soviets had exploded theirs, where America still has the monopoly, but a race in which Britain is desperate to participate.
So, in fact, very soon after the demonstration, the security services took an interest in Kaiser, and there was then what you describe as a flurry of cables between Canberra and London and Washington about this incident. What was going on there? What was this flurry of cables all about?
Well, ostensibly about whether or not he should return to Australia to face charges about protesting against his government, which had sent him on this scholarship to London. But the reality is far different and far more complex, and it's to do with the need for the Australians to appear to be safe in terms of security. There had been some actual evidence of Soviet espionage in this regard, and Kaiser was, to an extent, caught up in this.
I expect you're wondering what all this is in aid of.
If that doesn't incriminate me.
Do you know anything of a young man called Sawbridge?
Well, I was present at his interview.
We have an idea that the young man may not have been altogether wise.
Have you got anything definite against him?
Two facts. Number one, he attended anti-war meetings in 1940 and 1941. Number two, he was a member of the Communist Party at university.
It's a free country.
Small thanks to our communist friends.
The British and American authorities had strong reasons to be concerned about nuclear security. In 1946, a British nuclear physicist, Dr. Alan Nunn May, had been arrested and convicted of espionage. May had passed details of the British and American nuclear programs to the Soviets. As another Australian physicist, Mark Oliphant, said at the time, since the Nunn May case, no scientist is above suspicion. By mid-1949, the United States in particular was growing increasingly touchy about Australian nuclear security and Australian nuclear scientists. In July, Prime Minister Chifley sent his top defence bureaucrat, Frederick Shedden, on a special mission to Washington and London.
Shedden was still participating at the very time that Kaiser was protesting in a Washington-London trip to try and persuade the State Department, in Washington in particular, that Australia was secure. In other words, its security services were up to scratch. There were no breaches in letting through classified information and so on. This wasn't the mood, this wasn't the time for toleration of any actions which could interfere with that impression of a strong security service.
So in other words, an Australian scientist working on matters that could potentially be related to the nuclear weapons program, who was moreover a communist and who suddenly was in the newspapers at a demonstration in London organised by the Communist Party, was the last thing that the Chifley government needed at this particular point.
Yeah, the timing was quite crucial. Just a few months before this demonstration, in fact the 2nd of March 1949, Chifley, or the Labor government more generally, had established ASIO. Now, ASIO wasn't established merely because of the fear by the government of communism. It was one of the many measures taken to demonstrate to the British and to the Americans that the government was serious about communism, that its anti-communist credentials were strong, and thereby Australia could participate more fully in this Anglo-American atomic development program.
I suppose he told you about Sawbridge.
Yes.
How much is there in it?
If you mean that our security service has cleverly found out that Sawbridge is left wing, that's not exactly news.
A scene from the BBC TV production of Strangers and Brothers. It's an epic series of novels by C.P. Snow, which tells the story of the British nuclear weapons program and the scientists who worked on it.
If Captain Hook and his friends intend to eliminate all the left-wing people working on fission here and in America, there won't be enough of us left to finish the job.
Many openly left-wing scientists worked on the British bomb during the Second World War. And even after the war, Professor J.D. Bernal, an outspoken Marxist, continued to advise the British government on nuclear matters.
I agree, but can you imagine him fanatical enough to give secrets away?
Under some circumstances, I can imagine better men giving them away. Can't you?
When the Lord Privy Seal, Sir John Anderson, was told that Bernal was a security risk, he replied, "Even if he's as red as the flames of hell, I still want him as principal scientific consultant." But in Australia, as Philip Deary says, it wasn't the time for toleration.
He was dismissed from the CSIRO and thereby lost his scholarship on rather spurious grounds. And these grounds had to do with his refusal to return to Australia to attend another hearing. And he said, "No, I'm staying put."
May I apologise for any embarrassment which the, to me, rather irresponsible press reports have caused to you or to the executive of the CSIRO?
Eventually he did go back to try and clear his name, made several attempts to see various bureaucrats to try and understand what underpinned the allegations, because it was still a bit of a mystery.
I know of no legal or moral bar to my holding political opinions and taking political action in support of those opinions, and I'm sure that there can be no question of criticism of my work, both in Australia and at Oxford, and of my loyalty as an officer of CSIRO.
It was still seemed to be worthy at most of a reprimand. He still thought, OK, he might have acted a bit foolishly, but it wasn't worthy of dismissal. And again, it was for these reasons of which he was only, you know, not vaguely, he was completely unaware.
And tell us a little bit more about Kaiser. What sort of a man was he? What kind of background did he come from?
Kaiser was a working-class boy, lived in Ivanhoe in Melbourne, a Melbourne, northern Melbourne suburb. won a scholarship to Melbourne University, because that was, of course, the only university operating then in Melbourne in the post-war period, and did remarkably well. Came out with honours, and that enabled him to be chosen as one of the scholarship holders under the umbrella of the CSIRO to study in Oxford. So he was a very bright boy, but had that sort of working class background. But he was also someone, and I've talked to a great many people who knew him, who was rather stubborn, and he would refuse to budge. If he believed in something, he wouldn't easily give way. So perhaps it's not surprising that he was prepared against perhaps the sort of political sensibilities of the time, that he was prepared to demonstrate, as he did in July 1949.
Yet the Kaiser affair grew, at least in part, from a scientific misunderstanding. Despite the newspaper headlines, Tom Kaiser was not a nuclear physicist. He'd done most of his research on radar, and at the time of the demonstration, he was working on a machine called the Betatron.
No, the Betatron was not a high-security thing. People were making accelerating machines all over the world, America and in Europe and Russia and England. It was a sort of competition. Who can make electrons or protons travel fastest?
So he wasn't actually then working directly on an area of nuclear physics that might have had an application to the development of nuclear power or the development of nuclear weapons?
No, the main concentration of nuclear weapons was the fission of uranium, in which you split a heavy uranium nucleus and get energy out, or the fusion, where you glue two hydrogens together to make helium and get energy out. And I don't think he knew any more about the details of fusion or fission than I did, which was not very much.
Jack Kelly, who's Emeritus Professor of Physics at the University of New South Wales. Jack Kelly knew Tom Kaiser as a friend and colleague in the 1950s. But given the highly publicised cases of scientists like Alan Nunn May and Klaus Fuchs, both of whom passed nuclear secrets to the Soviets, was it understandable that the authorities decided they couldn't take a risk with Tom Kaiser?
Oh, it's perfectly understandable. The basis of all security things is paranoia, which is, on occasion, justified. But Fuchs and the others, in fact, worked on the bomb project. They had sort of hands-on, if one can say hands-on about plutonium, experience of the whole thing. They had real secrets. Kaiser was a PhD student. Now, he had a bit of previous experience, but PhD students are not given serious secrets. And looking at his background as a radio physicist in Australia, it's extremely unlikely that he would have been involved in any of this. Now, of course, yes, you could say that he was a member of the Communist Party and was secretly programmed to go to Oxford. But if you're going to send an agent somewhere, you don't send them to be a PhD student in Oxford, where, as far as I know, very few atom bombs were made. It would be very difficult for a PhD student in Oxford to get his hands on any secrets of real value.
Anyway, you ought to know that to a scientist, secrecy is evil. Even if in time of war it's a necessary evil. Science is, by definition, universal. That's why it conquers. If it dwindles away into little secret groups, hiding their results from each other, it'll become no better than a set of recipes. Within a generation, it will have lost all its ideals and most of its efficacy.
Tom Kaiser, in fact, attempted, having failed to be reinstated at the CSIRO, he then attempted to apply for university jobs in Australia, but was unsuccessful.
I think he'd been unsuccessful, or he told me when I interviewed him in 1997, which is not long before he died, that he'd applied in Australia and New Zealand for approximately 40 jobs. There was one in particular that he thought he had a very good chance of getting because he made it through to the shortlist, but the shortlist became a blacklist, at the University of New England for a professorship in physics. And he was judged the most brilliant candidate, the one with the very strong international reputation, highly credentialed referees, extensive publications, but the report of the selection committee or the chair of the selection committee proved to be lethal, and it was simply not suitable in view of past political activities.
In effect, Tom Kaiser was blacklisted in his own country. To understand fully why this happened, we need to go back to the very earliest days of the Cold War. During World War II, Britain and the United States had cooperated on developing the atomic bomb. British scientists had gone to America to work on the Manhattan Project. But less than a year after the end of the war, the United States terminated the nuclear special relationship.
Well, the vital turning point is the decision in the United States to effectively end cooperation with the British in the development of this technology. Senator Brian McMahon succeeds in 1946 in putting an act through the American Congress, which the Atomic Energy Act, which effectively bans cooperation with the British on the development of nuclear weapons between 1946 and 1957. So Australia's role as a substitute for the United States in that period is pretty vital.
So why does McMahon do this?
Well, a number of things, and it's not just McMahon. Behind the role of the Congress is the thinking of the Pentagon, the planning staff, and they say that the development of reactors in Great Britain is far too close to the potential enemy, Nazi Germany, and of course, after World War II, the Soviet Union. And this had been rammed home dramatically by the aerial blitz of 1940 and the V-bomb blitz of 1944-45. The second reason, the Americans do not have a lot of uranium in their stockpile. They are heavily dependent on scarce resources in the Belgian Congo and Canada, so they don't want to divert, as they see it, the resources to an alternative program or a separate program in the United Kingdom. The final concern is the potential for leaks of classified information from British establishments, British scientists to the Soviet Union.
Starting early this year, a picked group of men of the Australian Army and Royal Australian Air Force began building a camp with an airfield out in the desert far to the northwest of Woomera, although still within the immense Woomera guided missiles range. More than three quarters of its supplies were flown in by the RAAF and the RAF. It was the Royal Air Force Transport Command that actually brought the weapon itself to the site.
So in other words, there are good reasons why the British believe then that they need us for the development of their nuclear weapons program.
That's right. It's absolutely crucial, Tom. In that period, particularly after 1946, when it's clear that the United States and the Canadians are not going to collaborate with the British, it's absolutely vital that they pursue the development of fissile material, use empire scientists, and ultimately test weapons, and not just nuclear weapons, weapons of mass destruction generally, in various parts of the British Empire.
Wayne Reynolds is Senior Lecturer in History at Newcastle University.
On the horizon, about 14 miles away and to the south of the rising sun, were two towers, standing perhaps 200 feet high. The one nearer the bomb held the weapon and its instruments. Both look very small and very distant.
In the past, historians have seen Australia as a passive participant in the new atomic empire, dutifully carrying out directions from London. But Wayne Reynolds says new evidence from the archives and declassified documents presents a very different picture of an Australian government actively seeking to become a nuclear power.
Ben Chifley was very keen to see the development of uranium in Australia and a related potentially fissile material, thorium. He was also very keen to develop the closest research links with the British, prepared to land people like Mark Oliphant to the Manhattan program, the British Manhattan program, what they call MAUD, in Great Britain. And ultimately, Chifley foreshadows that these scientists will come back to Australia and develop atomic piles here for industrial purposes.
So we've got those three components, but is there an assumption in these early post-war years, and indeed a desire on the part of Chifley and more broadly in Australia, for Australia to acquire nuclear weapons?
Well, there are various players in that. The Air Vice Marshal Williams from the Air Force advocates the use of atomic weapons by the end of 1945, pointing out the potential advantage of a weapon like this to a remote and potentially isolated country like Australia. Dr. Evatt, the Foreign Minister and Attorney General, very keen to see the development of a dual-purpose capability. Chifley himself is aware that when you develop atomic energy for industrial purposes, you also simultaneously and necessarily develop the technology for military purposes. Chifley would also be aware that from World War II until, well after his death, in fact, but all through that period, the driver of the development of atomic power is military. It is not industrial.
And prepare to give ready.
Then the firing sequence began. The final minutes were counted out over the loudspeaker. Then the last few seconds came, and it seemed that they would never end.
25. 20.
In 1948, Australia's countdown to 50. Nuclear power status suffered an unexpected interruption. The United States restored partial cooperation with Britain on nuclear research, under an agreement called the Modus Vivendi.
The Americans, if you like, are sending the first sign that if the British play their cards right, they might yet come in out of the cold. Remember that it was only in 1946 that they had been cut out. By 1948, they have some evidence that the Americans might be changing their tune. Now, this is the ambiguity in the British position, and it goes all through the post-war period right down to 1957. At what point can they get access to the much more important American program and thereby forego their reliance on the empire, which is very much a second best? But the other side of the coin, in case the British don't take the carrot, is the stick. And the Americans announce that the Australians have a security problem, and they announce an intelligence embargo on the sharing of information with the Australian government in the middle of 1948. And they also insist that any information given to Great Britain by the United States not be shared with the Australians or indeed the South Africans as a part of that process.
The weak link in the chain, so it seemed, was Australia. And Australia being leaky, as I said before, and with having scientists like Kaiser, who are alleged to be communist, undermined that attempt of Britain, with whom Australia was collaborating for the development of the atom bomb, undermined that attempt to share very important atomic information with the Americans.
By the middle of 1948, the Chifley government was coming under extraordinary pressure from its two most important allies. Chifley and his cabinet found the American security embargo frustrating and humiliating. In September, Chifley's Minister of Defence, J.J. Dedman, visited the American ambassador in Canberra three times, asking to have the embargo lifted. After the meetings, the ambassador sent a top-secret cable to Washington, direct to the Secretary of State, Dean Acheson.
To assure UK and US regarding security, Dedman said Australia willing to accept UK security expert to be stationed here. Also US expert if we desired send one. Both would be given every opportunity to ascertain for themselves degree of security existing in Australia. Several times during conversations, Minister admitted that number of communists are employed in government, but insisted none employed where security affected. I listened attentively to what Dedman said and told him would report his remarks Washington. I informed him, however, that quite frankly, I could not hold out hope that our decision, taken with reluctance after most careful consideration at highest level, would be modified until we were entirely satisfied security system had been thoroughly overhauled and strengthened.
trying to understand the full dimensions of the Kaiser case is a bit like working your way through a thriller by John le Carré. It's like peeling away the skins of an onion. Every time you think you know what's going on, you realise there's another skin of intrigue further down. Because there were even deeper and darker reasons for American sensitivities about Australian security. Reasons which remained secret until more than 40 years later, when the Cold War had already come to an end. It wasn't until the early 1990s that the United States revealed the existence of the Venona decrypts.
Well, the Venona, the term Venona is a code name for what Ball and Horner have shown as one of the most astounding cryptoanalytic breakthroughs in the history of intelligence, namely the code-breaking efforts of cryptographers in Washington to unravel the seemingly unbreakable coded information sent from embassies, including the Soviet embassy in Canberra, to Moscow Center, as it was called. Those cables included information that there was a Soviet spy ring, and this is very much within the Cold War mentality, a Soviet spy ring within Dr. Evatt's own department. In other words, within the External Affairs Department, and Dr. Evatt was also Deputy Prime Minister, within the External Affairs Department there was a group known as the Clod Group, K-L-O-D, which was passing top secret or classified information. Once the Americans learned of that, they were terribly concerned and anxious and dubious about Australia's capacity to be a repository of classified information.
What we know from Venona now is that toward the end of the Second World War, there were at least two undercover members of the Communist Party who were employed in the Department of External Affairs, and they gave documents, or got documents to KGB people here in Australia. We don't know precisely how it happened, but we know it did happen. And these were the people later on, or this was the situation that later on was referred to as the nest of traitors, and you know, the phrase itself being, you know, highly emotive and so on. But nevertheless, we know that espionage took place, what was regarded as espionage later on. What was at the time a couple of leftists thinking that they were doing their political international duty in defending and protecting the Soviet Union.
David McKnight, author of Espionage and the Roots of the Cold War.